It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Over the past year, lawmakers on the Joint Legislative Audit Committee have ordered performance evaluations of certain state agencies and programs.
From financial monitoring efforts within the State Education Department to a newly released audit on DEI, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion program spending in the universities of Wisconsin system.
The audits are performed by the nonpartisan Legislative Audit Bureau. The results are beginning to be published.
To talk about the findings, we're joined by Republican State Senator Eric Wimberger of Oconto. He is co-chair of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee and serves on the Joint Finance Committee. State Senator Wimberger, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Yeah, thanks for having me again. Glad to talk to you.
Yes, Republican state lawmakers, they have pushed for years to end DEI programs. What did you learn from this audit about DEI activities in Wisconsin's higher ed that is new to you?
Well, I guess the first glaring thing is that no one has ever really defined it on a holistic manner. Each department has their own thing. There's some kind of nebulous concepts. And then on, I don't know, because of politics, a lot of money has been shoved into these activities with no clear purpose. And obviously that's separate from whether they philosophically should be done to begin with, I suppose.
How do you feel about what you're seeing in this audit in terms of what is actionable to you as a state senator?
Sure. It's real difficult. Because they'll hide it in their normal affirmative action policies that have been around since the 70s. So you'll have people who do those things, but then for a quarter time are supposed to do DEI. And this is all related to, at least on the non-UW side, is related to Executive Order 59, specifically on DEI. The UW system has their own DEI policies with the Board of Regents. But it's real hard to pin this down because it's commingled, and the missions are quite separate. If you look at the affirmative action statute, it talks about legacies of past discrimination, but that is not the mission of DEI. The mission of DEI is to make other people feel welcomed, which creates a dynamic that has persisted for a couple of decades now, which is the most extreme. Just say they don't feel a certain way, and then they cajole additional programs, their own things going on. So there's no real end game, and there's no tracking of it, and there's no definitions. It's real tough.
So in a statement, UW President Jay Rothman said the audit numbers are, quote, old and cold, and that for more than a year, the UW has been taking action to reduce and reorient DEI positions toward individual student success. So is this audit evaluating a previous version of the UW that is not reflective today?
Well, I think that's an interesting phrase. I don't know if it's old and cold, but it's the audit does a snapshot in time, obviously. It's not a continuing report. So if you recall, a couple years back was the whole debate over the engineering building and the DEI positions there.
Yeah.
So I guess I wouldn't be totally surprised if there's some inaccuracy because of a continuing effort to comply with that that agreement. Nonetheless, there's more going on, and we can pare it down. It's not like it's for sure, but it's certainly a good starting point to have a discussion.
We can pare it down. What do you mean by that?
Well, perhaps there are some things being done at the UW system that are taking care of the problems that we find out in the DEI report. So this snapshot that comes with an audit, certainly things are dynamic, and I don't think the legislature would overreact. It will certainly work to find out what's going on.
So do you see this audit then as a starting place for lawmakers? How will your legislative audit committee use the results that you see here?
I think that the audit committee is the starting place for a lot of things. We do investigation and oversight to try and find problems or at least investigate things. And if people don't think the thing going on is a problem, I guess you don't do anything about it. But we expose the things going on in government, and we have no really authority beyond that. So other legislators, or perhaps myself, I'd come up with a bill to address something that might be in an audit, in this one or any other audit.
Will you do that?
DEI is a real slippery concept, and I certainly would like to give it a shot, but I think it's too early to say anything more definitive about how I might respond. Obviously, there's budgeting going on right now, so we'll see what we can come up with. But because the concepts are so nebulous and everything is commingled, it will require some hard dissection of what's what with some finite terms and goals.
Looking at this other report that came out, the Legislative Audit Bureau on its findings on DEI activities within the Department of Administration, which monitors and supports the DEI activities of most state agencies. In that report, Secretary Kathy Blumenfeld said in the letter to the Bureau that most of the costs are tied to programming that is not easily separated from the state's legal obligations, nor is it easily separated from other human resource best practices. So what does this particular audit illuminate to you?
Well, I don't think that, just like the UW audit, this is a lot of the same things. I don't think that it can't be separated or figured out. Is there's been a deliberate act to commingle it. So while you, in some ways, you can dissect it, in that there is no particular DEI plan for a department, but there they are sending people on trips, trainings elsewhere that can't, you can figure out how much those things spent. But in other ways, they're taking their normal non-discrimination people, which is great, but then having them work a quarter time on something that isn't related to non-discrimination, really, it's actually a discriminatory policy. And how do you, the auditors basically said, well, if you work a quarter of your time on that by the standard, then we're just going to count your salary, a quarter of your salary, as what the value of that is. But obviously, we're not going to necessarily terminate that person because they're doing things that you do want them to do as well. So how you figure that out by reduction of staff naturally, or just having them do the tasks that they used to do prior to this Executive Order 59, I think is going to be the way to go.
Talking with Republican State Senator Eric Wimberger, co-chair of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, about recent and upcoming audits that assess the performance and finances of certain state agencies and programs. Turning to an upcoming audit here, a couple of the audits in progress involve Department of Public Instruction, one set to release this spring, examining how the state education department monitors the financial information of schools. What do you want to learn from this investigation?
Oh boy, this one is really crucial to the largest budgetary expense we have. We spend $15 billion, 15% roughly, of our entire budget on K-12 education. And what is the catalyst to this is that for 2 years, Milwaukee Public Schools were not doing their annual required auditing in order to come up with accurate numbers to plug into the school funding formula. So it got to the point where DPI decided to yank $80 million from them, and which was 10% of their budget. And you don't hear about that. You know, I think that's astonishing that a 10% cut in their budget, and no one bats an eye in the public here, but that went on. And so, but in that mix, before they cut the budget by 10%, Milwaukee was induced to pass a $200 million referendum on claims that the schools needed the extra money. So they passed a referendum, a month later, yanked the funding for failure to comply with the method that we use to find out what they need. And that's a terrible situation. So we got to figure out what DPI is up to in coordinating with or holding people, school districts to account to make sure that they're getting accurate data and we're actually giving money to schools in a method that they need it.
Okay. I know this is a newsflash, but we're in the thick of budget rating season. And before we have to let you go, you know, given the level of uncertainty in the federal government and the cuts to agencies and programs by President Trump and DOGE, How will that affect the next budget of Wisconsin?
Well, probably not a whole lot. I mean, they're going to, from what I gather, it's just going to be block grants administered by the state. We administer a whole lot of federal programming, so it's I think it'll all work out just fine. If there's some problem that happens, I mean, people talk about Medicaid cuts and all that. If that were to actually happen, I think we would certainly take action to make sure nothing bad happened to people in Wisconsin. But I really don't foresee that. The biggest problem with the budgeting is the fact that the state Supreme Court changed the rules on how we budget. So we would be very content with giving the executive branch, I don't know, $100 million for this or for that program, and with a caveat that you got to come back to the Finance Committee with a discernible plan, and then we'll approve that plan. The Supreme Court said that was a non-delegation issue in the Constitution, and okay, but in Wisconsin we have the line item veto. So if Governor Evers has that power, if we want to put something specific into the budget, he might line item veto that. So how we lose the power of the purse. And that's going to be a real difficult question. That's going to be the more important budgetary issue, I think, this year.
And just for clarity, as we're out the door here, if you see Medicaid cuts at the federal level, Wisconsin would step in to backfill Medicaid if something happens?
Well, I certainly would advocate for that.
Okay.
I mean, people in need should not have a suffer from that, but I just don't see that. I think it would be just more block grants. But the actual services, if that were to ever come to pass, I think they're just cutting, fraud and abuse. But people are, people are worried when things like this is upsetting the norm. But I certainly would encourage my legislative colleagues to step in and we'd take care of our own here.
Senator Wimberger, good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me again.
Eric Wimberger is a Republican state senator for Wisconsin's 2nd Senate District, covers all of Menominee County, parts of Oconto, Shawano, Outagamie, and Brown counties. He's co-chair of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, serves on Joint Finance Committee as well.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a UW-Madison professor works on authenticating a possible lost Van Gogh painting.
The first time you look at it, you would say, "What? That's not a Van Gogh." Everybody knows what a Van Gogh looks like. It's a picture of a fisherman in a fur cap with a pipe, mending a net.
An art world mystery ahead on WPR News.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. After Milwaukee saw record numbers of homicides 3 years in a row, murders have been trending down in the city over the past 2 years.
Evan Casey has a look behind the effort to keep those numbers down in the city.
How you doing, brother? Can I give you one of these?
Stephen Hopkins and Jose Malave are out on Milwaukee's north side on a windy spring day, handing out brochures for victims of violence. Just weeks earlier, a 16-year-old and a 27-year-old were shot and killed in a nearby park.
And this is typical at this time of year. We get super busy. As you know, when the weather changes,
sun's out, guns out.
The two men are with the city's critical response team. After several bad years, they're seeing some progress. Even after the recent incident, Hopkins says non-fatal shootings are still down in the city compared to last year.
We want to keep that momentum going. Even though we know that it may spike in spring and summer, we just want to keep that momentum going.
Like many larger cities, homicides spiked in Milwaukee during the pandemic. In 2022, 214 people lost their lives to homicide. That was the highest number ever recorded in the city. But there were 172 homicides in 2023. Last year, it went down again to 132. That's still above pre-pandemic numbers. But activists and officials say they're encouraged by the declines. Now, they hope to build on that progress.
Good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon.
Days after the start of the new year in 2023, community organizers gathered to call for peace after yet another deadly year. Now, over 2 years later, many of those same leaders are meeting again, this time to talk about what's working. David Muhammad, Milwaukee County's Deputy Director for the Department of Health and Human Services, is running the meeting at Turner Hall in downtown Milwaukee. He says the decline is an encouraging trend.
This is happening at a time where there are less police, limited budgets, challenges in the school district. So the perfect storm of negativity is still happening, but the positive decisions are also being made by people in the community.
Leaders in the community have pointed to violence prevention initiatives, like the Critical Response Team, as one of the factors behind the decline. Karen Tyler of the city's Office of Community Wellness and Safety says members of that team work to mediate conflicts between gangs.
There may be a homicide, and then we're trying to get ahead to make sure people don't retaliate against that person, and then, you know, the violence continues.
Jose Malave is a former gang member. He works with the team now because he says he wants to save lives.
You know, I'm tired of seeing all the youth killing each other every day, going to jail, going in and out of jail. So, you know, I wanted to make an impact on my community.
Another violence prevention effort is 414 Life. Reggie Moore is the director of Violence Prevention Policy and Engagement at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and he works with that team. He says members worked in a, quote, priority neighborhood last year and saw a decline in both homicides and shootings.
Not just building relationships with business owners and residents, but also the young people hanging out on the corner or the adults hanging out on the corner or individuals, again, who are known, you know, to be involved in things that could lead to violence in their lives.
Although homicides are down in Milwaukee, they still haven't gone down to pre-pandemic levels. And as of this week, the city has had two fewer homicides in 2025 than it had at this time last year. Community activists like Tracy Dent saying there's more work that needs to be done.
As a violence is a constant, the solution also has to stay as a constant. Even though sometimes you need to go back and reevaluate what works, what doesn't work, it still has to continue.
Moore says a 2017 city plan aimed at addressing violence in the city needs to be updated. He called that the city's, quote, North Star to address the issue. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Today.
There's a $15 million mystery to solve in our backyard, and it started with an old painting found at a Minnesota garage sale.
It's a picture of a fisherman in a fur cap with a pipe mending a net, and you see the ocean behind him, and the ocean is calm. And he seems to be very pensive, and he's looking at the net that he's mending.
That's Susan Brantley, professor of Scandinavian Studies at UW-Madison. A few years back, she got the call that her expertise in reading and analyzing 19th century literature from Denmark was needed to authenticate this painting of a fisherman. It's thought to be a long-lost work by the acclaimed Dutch painter Vincent van Gogh.
The first time you look at it, you would say, what, that's not a Van Gogh. Everybody knows what a Van Gogh looks like.
You know, starry night, sunflowers. This fisherman is not them. But while researching the painting with a team of art historians, data scientists, and other experts, Brantley became convinced that they had a real Van Gogh on their hands.
After years of research, the painting called Elemar is making headlines. The question remains, is it a Van Gogh? The authentication firm says yes, but the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam recently said nope, leaving it an unsettled question in the art world.
Susan Brantley joined us to talk about her experience digging into this mystery and what it was like to get the call about a possible Van Gogh.
It was marvelous. I mean, granted, because a non-disclosure agreement was signed, I didn't know initially what the call was about, that there was some painter or another, and they needed some information that had to do with Danish, you know, literature. And so would I be willing to help them out? Sure. And then came the reveal. I just was grinning from ear to ear. I couldn't have been happier. I thought, oh, this is too cool for words.
What brought you so much joy?
What brings me joy is that I have, for decades, used visual art to illustrate my literature lectures. In fact, there's an episode on Wisconsin Public Television called Scandinavian Art and Literature where you can kind of see me doing exactly that. So I have always been, shall we say, a frustrated art historian. And here I get called to work with these experts who do know what they're doing. I promise you they do. And to realize that the skills that I've been developing over a lifetime are valuable.
Mm. What does Elamar mean in the painting?
And that was my first task. It was fine. So what does Elamar mean? And I did a search through, I mean, the Hathi Trust has a wonderful collection of older scanned-in documents. And so I was searching for Elamar to see what came up. And the first thing that comes up is that Elamar is the hereditary sort of founder of the Duchy of Oldenburg. But then there is this character in a novel by Hans Christian Andersen, and the novel is called The Two Baronesses. And so the other Elamars that I ran across just made no sense in terms of this image, because the Elamar is actually it's an aristocratic name. It's an upper-class name. It's not like Niels or, you know, something like that that you would expect a fisherman to be called. So there is something a little odd about that. And so I kept, you know, looking, finding Elamars who, like I said, there were just no residents, nothing. But you look at Hans Christian Andersen's novel, and it is set, well, it has three parts. First and last parts are set in Denmark. The middle part takes place in the Hallinger Islands, which belonged to Denmark at this time, now belong to Germany, but there are Frisian speakers. It's this sort of North Country, North Sea culture, as I call it, that has fishermen in it, among other things.
No surprise there.
That's right. And a character called Elamar, who is studying to be a naval officer of some kind. And we meet him when he's a young man. And he heroically rescues one of the two titular baronesses when she's a child from an incoming flood, the tides coming in, and he saves her. He is at the same time kind of a complicated – he's a bad boy too. He gets in trouble and does all kinds of things. But the impact is that Elizabeth, who is the will-be-a baroness someday character – just falls madly in love with him, gets this terrible crush on him, and thinks about him all the time. And so Elamar, actually, whether he's on site for very long, he isn't really, but he's talked about a lot. He figures in Elizabeth's imagination in a number of the stories. And one of the more interesting stories about Elamar is that he has an ancestor who was prone to violent fits, and during a violent psychological fit, killed a person. Mm. And he ran away, leaving his wife and children to fend for themselves. And she worked, everybody admired her because she worked hard to feed her children and, you know, pay the fine. And this went on for a number of years. And then the people noticed that she was pregnant. Oh, my gosh. Mm. You know, what's going on here? And they follow her, and they find that she, over these years, has been meeting her husband, who's been actually hiding out in the dunes for years. And this faithfulness of the good woman makes everybody forgive Elamar's ancestor. And he's restored to his position in society and becomes wealthy and prosperous, and they live happily ever after, right?
How it goes. But how would Elamar then, how would Van Gogh be interested in this character?
Well, because he himself was prone to these fits, right? The famous fit, you know, Gauguin is living with him in the Yellow House, and he has this psychotic break during which he cuts off his ear. Mm-hmm. And then he ends up in an asylum. And this was something that he had clearly struggled with his entire life. And so, you know, at what point he read the story, I rather suspect he read it as a very young man, maybe even a child. But it stuck because here's someone who has one of these fits, and it turns out okay, that there's a remedy, that there's a way out of it. And so I think that that makes this sort of Elamar figure a very attractive one.
So in a literary sense, then, my guess is you think that this is a Van Gogh.
I'm completely convinced because of the stories that you can read into this image. Mm-hmm. One of the things that really got me excited, yes, you know, I, you know, found LMR. That's great. The next thing I was able to use my skills for was reading correspondence. I can read 19th century handwriting. Can you?
You know, no.
That's not everybody who can, in Danish, no less. And there was a young Danish art student painter living in the south of France who met Van Gogh. Christian Maria Petersen. And so I read through the letters that he was writing home to his friend Johan Rode, who's also an art student and an artist, and not perhaps so coincidentally becomes known for introducing Van Gogh's art to Denmark. And so reading these letters gave me some insight into, you know, what it was to be an art student. And that involves copying things. You know, making, you know, either sketches or, you know, quick copies for reference later. And so Christian Maria Petersen had saved his pennies and had gone to the south of France to become an artist. Maybe he had in his portfolio a copy of Michael Unker, who was so well known during the years he was an art student. You know, is that where perhaps Van Gogh might have seen this image in order to be able to replicate it later? Well, so that was very interesting. So that's my favorite theory. But then the scientific experts that the LMI group, who's the one who's been investigating this, they got together. They did an infrared scan. And so there are images not visible to the eye that you can see basically on either shoulder of the fisherman. On the one side is what looks like a boat, an empty boat that's been pulled up on the shore. On the other side is a sketch that rather looks like a woman, perhaps a child, and a cradle. And it's when I start getting into the stories behind those that it just makes so much sense.
You start connecting the dots.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And so I just want to stop here for a moment.
Sure.
To realize that the theories that you are bringing to this mystery are layered upon other types of expertise, like
Completely.
The scanning and like the investigation of a hair found
Yep.
in a particular corner and the paint used.
Yeah. And that's what they do very well. That is this data-driven research. Mm-hmm. I'm a storyteller. You know, stories are my area of expertise. And everything they looked at, nothing disqualifies this painting from being by Van Gogh. That the patents for the paint colors, for example, are all of that era. They're not from last week or anything like that. So, and that's their business. And it certainly encourages me to have even greater confidence in the stories that I have found and can sort of relate to Van Gogh and his situation. Especially if indeed this was painted while he was in the asylum after having cut his ear off.
But the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam has said no, and it has said no again, that it is not authentic. What do you feel about that? How does that make you feel?
Well, I'm a little disappointed, but actually mostly surprised. This is the first time I've ever been in these sort of exalted fine art circles and am learning astonishing things about, you know, reputations are at stake, not to mention a great deal of money, right? I read in a New York Times article that someone sued the Van Gogh Museum for millions of dollars because they hadn't authenticated a painting. And suddenly it was like, oh my gosh, no wonder. Yeah, no wonder everybody's being so very careful. But I don't have anything at stake here. And I and actually the rest of the team are confident that this is, in fact, an actual Van Gogh. And we can explain it. And there is that report online that's 458 pages long. And, you know, there's evidence. There's evidence. But there's resistance, too, because, again, professional reputations are at stake. And at first glance, I agree. You go, what? That's not Van Gogh. But, again, the more you know about it, the more sense it makes.
I want to ask you in closing, has this project and working on this changed any way you see your work in the classroom or how you interact with your own research and how you teach students?
Yes, I would say, well, actually, when I finally, when the non-disclosure thing evaporated, the first thing I did was I went and I told all my classes. I couldn't help it. I hadn't been able to speak to it for years at that point. And so, you know, I just sort of was so excited that I just told my students all about it. But, you know, as I said, I've always sort of taught using visual art. And this whole project sort of circles back to research I had done. My first book is on a woman named Laura Marholm, who was, you know, moved around in Europe and associated with these folks in Copenhagen in the 1880s. So it's, you start getting familiar with the territory and the cast of characters. And it, you know, Copenhagen, big city, small town in some ways. Mm. You know, it's surprising how absolutely interconnected everything was. But then going back to future, I'm not done with this. I'm not done with this. I'm still kind of, I think about it all the time. I think there are more things that I would like to find out, more questions I would like to answer about it. So I'm still working on it.
Susan, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. This has been fun. I love talking about this stuff.
That is Susan Brantley, professor in the Department of German, Nordic, and Slavic at UW-Madison. She had a once-in-a-lifetime experience of helping to authenticate a possible long-lost Van Gogh painting found at a Minnesota garage sale in 2016. Brantley is giving a presentation about the Van Gogh authentication journey. It is set for Saturday, May 3rd at UW-Madison. The event is free and open to the public.
Coming up, meet Wisconsinites who navigate through nature with a compass and a map.
We always hold beginners clinics, and it's amazing how what people come away with as far as their ability to interpret the map.
It's the sport of orienteering coming up on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Orienteering is a sport where participants navigate through a natural landscape with nothing but a map and a compass, seeing who can complete a course first.
It was created in the late 1800s in Europe, and now it's catching on in the U.S. To learn more, we're joined by Wisconsinites helping to grow the sport.
Susie Madden is co-president and mapping director of the Badger Orienteering Club and president of On the Map, a nonprofit dedicated to introducing more people to the sport. And Tom Southworth is secretary of the club. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
And Susie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Can you, Susie, start us off with the basics? What are we doing when we're orienteering?
Well, when we're orienteering, we're using a highly detailed map along with a compass to locate a series of markers that have been preset on a course throughout a park. So we use this detailed map, which is marked with these locations of the flags, and we start walking in a series, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, until we found them all. A clock is timing us while we're doing it. And when you get back, when you finish your course, you find out how long it took you to do the course. It's super fun, like a treasure hunt in the woods or in a park.
Tom, can you talk about the mix of skills? Because obviously you get to be out in the outdoors and you're moving. There is a serious mental side here of navigating with map and compass, too.
Exactly. Sometimes orienteering is called the thinking sport because not only are you out there exercising physically, you're also having to mentally choose routes and decide the best way to go and look ahead to what might be obstacles to get to that next control. And so each control is like a little mental puzzle to go on. You might have to decide, do I want to go out of my way to take a trail or am I going to cut through the woods and try to keep my bearings as I go with my map and compass. So it's definitely a thinking sport and gives you the benefit of both.
Both of you are clearly very into orienteering. Susie, what got you into this sport?
Well, my background is in cartography. I'm a map maker by training and experience, and naturally interested in maps. And when I found out there was a orienteering club in Wisconsin, I checked it out and went to my first event. Had a blast the first time, and that was about 17 years ago, and I've never stopped orienteering since then.
And Susie, staying with that mapping, I like maps too. My difficulty is sometimes translating what's on the map to what's in front of my actual face in the world. Is this a challenge for some people, like interpreting the map to the real world there?
Well, it's funny that you ask that. A lot of people think they can't read maps. They think that they don't have a sense of direction. I've heard many people say they just can't read maps. But in fact, there is no such thing as a sense of direction or an innate ability to read maps and interpret them. Anyone can learn how to read a map. And so, yes, we do have people who are intimidated by the idea, but it's a teachable skill. And so we actually strive to teach people how to read our map first. We always hold beginners clinics, and it's amazing how what people come away with as far as their ability to interpret the map.
And Tom, what brought you into orienteering?
I did not get in until I was close to 60 years old. I was always a camper. I'd done a lot of wilderness trips with some places where the maps were very rudimentary and often incorrect. So I liked navigating in the wilds. And even though I'm older and I'm much slower than a lot of the contestants, and so I'm definitely not competitive, it's a way for me to get out in the woods and have fun using my brain while I'm out there.
And Tom, did I see this right at events? So in addition to your map and your compass, people have a whistle with them if they're, you know, like me and just get completely lost.
They do have a whistle. And even though they're not allowed to use cell phones, they're not supposed to, according to the rules of orienteering. At our events, we always have a list of the cell phone numbers of people out in the woods so that if something seemed to be awry, we could attempt to contact them. And we're also aware of what route they're supposed to have taken. So it's not like, we hardly ever have to use that. Mm-hmm. That's not really something that's common to have anything happen to.
And Tom mentioning cell phones, Susie, that makes me think, you know, over my life, I've definitely gone from using paper maps or written out directions to get from point A to point B. Now more and more of us, of course, use GPS. Do you find that people enjoy that experience of not having the computer telling them where to go, but having to interpret them for themselves?
Absolutely. Yeah. People of all ages, older people who remember, you know, having to use maps before GPS came along, appreciate the opportunity to return to that skill and use it. And they see the importance of learning how to read a map. Young people enjoy it because it's something new to them. And they think, oh, cool, you know, check out this map. It shows us that there's going to be a stream coming up at the end of this trail. And sure enough, there's a stream. And they think it's really neat that there's a visual or a drawing of the earth around them, which you don't get from a computer. You don't get the same level of detail and interaction with the map.
If I could add something to that, that's also another one of the big benefits of orienteering. You mentioned Susie mentioned both the older people and the younger people. Studies have shown that older people that take part in these kind of activities where they're using their brains out in the forest and such, it does do good things for their brains as they age. And then young people, you also get the whole three-dimensional spatial learning that they're getting used to from using these maps. And so I think on both ends of the age group, there's a mental benefit to the sport.
We're talking about orienteering in Wisconsin. We have Tom Southworth and Susie Madden with us. They're both with the Badger Orienteering Club. Susie is also president of On the Map. That's a nonprofit that helps bring orienteering to more people. Tom, you had your first event of the season, I understand, at Blue Mound. I was looking at the results on your website. How'd the event go?
I think the courses were great. Congratulations to Susie on that, because she was one of the main setters for the course. If you looked at the result, you can see that I was the slowest time on the intermediate course, and which is fine with me. My goal was to get through it, find all the controls, and get back within about 3 hours, which I accomplished. So that's just an example of the fact that you can, it's a sport that you can kind of have your own goals and have your own level. You don't need to be competing with the 25-year-old ones that are running through the woods and accomplishing it in an hour.
Susie, what goes into setting a course for orienteering?
Well, the first thing you need is an up-to-date map. And that's a real challenge for any orienteering club, is the actual creation and maintenance of maps. The parks are always changing. Trails come and go. Vegetation becomes thicker or is clear cut. The earth is always changing, so maps are always changing. But a course setter needs a good map to start with. And then what they also need is a lot of experience orienteering. So you have to understand what makes a fun route choice and a challenging route choice for advanced orienteers, so that they are challenged, and you have to know where to keep them away from trails so that they can't default to an easy route. And for beginners, you have to be able to understand what, you know, just their level of comprehension is and design an easier course for them, but still very interesting.
Susie, that makes me wonder, you know, sometimes you're at parks, state or otherwise, and there are signs saying, hey, stay on the trails. Obviously, orienteering is an off-trail activity. How do you coordinate with the venue to make sure it's cool to walk through this bit here?
I kind of liken us to hunters, you know. Hunters wander, and they don't stay on the trails. They wander in the woods during hunting season. And so the parks really don't have, the state parks at least, don't have a problem with us on a very limited basis, having 1 to 2 events at a state park per year. Our numbers, our participation numbers are relatively low. We get 75-ish people at each event. So that's really not a lot of people traipsing through the woods off trail at a park on an annual basis. We have a really good relationship with the state of Wisconsin. They want to see their parks being used. And most park authorities have that that same goal. You know, they're there for the public to use the land.
Tom, if somebody's listening thinking, yeah, this sounds cool, but I've never done it before, how can somebody take this up? How can they get started?
Well, first thing I would recommend, checking our website for more information. It's badgerorienteering.com. That'll give our upcoming events. And each event has a beginner's clinic, like Susie mentioned, but they can register online. But they can, if somebody shows up for their first event and they don't go to the beginner's clinic, they'll be certainly ready to go on the beginner's course. And I was on the intermediate course yesterday, and I met a few people that was their first course, and they'd been to the beginner's clinic, and they decided to try the intermediate course, and they seemed to be doing fine. I mean, they beat me because I'm slow. I think that the nice thing is they can expect something that they can tailor to their own level.
Oh, and Tom, I should ask, people might be wondering, you know, Rob shows up at the finish line. How do you know I actually followed the course and didn't just sneak off on a trail? I got to get punched along the way, right?
Exactly. We have these things, we call them finger sticks, and they just slide like a ring on your finger, and it's electronic. And each control that Susie described has a little monitor on it that you stick it in the hole, or you wave it near it, and it gives a little beep and it lights up. And when you get done, you can you punch in and they get all your splits, how much time you took on each control. And later on when you get home, and or either late that day or the next day, you can look online and you can kind of see how you did on each leg.
Susie, as I mentioned, you're not just with the Badger Orienteering Club and you set these trails, but you've got this nonprofit called On the Map. Can you talk a little bit about what you're doing with On the Map to spread the word?
Well, On the Map is an organization that's focused primarily in Madison and Dane County. And we try to bring events to students, schools. We put events on for scouting troops, groups, people who want an organized activity and want to learn about orienteering. And I consider these events sort of a feeder to the Badger Orienteering Club events, which are located a little bit more distant. We operate out of four state parks in Wisconsin. It's a drive to get to these parks. For a lot of people, they'll travel 1 or 2 hours to get to one of our events. So I try to introduce the sport more locally at a grassroots level and just build the orienteering base and spread the word about orienteering. And there are a couple other similar organizations around the state that do the same thing. There's one in Eau Claire and there's someone in Green Bay that are working on more of a local level just to get people involved. And I will just quickly mention that in Europe, where orienteering is a really big deal and a very popular sport, every town or city will have their own orienteering club, and they will put on events and travel to each other's events. So it's much more distributed over in Europe. And I think that's why they've been able to grow the sport and make it so popular over the years.
All right, I got to ask the tough question here for both of you. Let's start with Tom. Have you ever gotten lost, or what's the closest you've come to getting lost on an orienteering mission, Tom?
I have had times where I was coming out of a wooded area and I was turned around and I got to a trail, and thinking I was going one way on the trail, I was foolish and didn't check my compass. And so I walked maybe a quarter, half a mile along, and something didn't seem right with the map. And I had to stop and take a look at it and figure out what I had actually done and then fix it. So it was a lot of extra steps to go where I was going. But it's hard to get completely lost, because generally speaking, you've got your compass and you're going to know if I just go, say, east, I'm going to hit that county road. You know, you're not going to get lost where you can't figure out a way out.
And how about you, Susie?
Yeah, like Tom said, it's not really getting lost. It's getting disoriented. I have been disoriented many times. I've done foolish things, even after I became an expert orienteer. When I'm out on the course, maybe halfway through a 2-hour course, my brain gets tired as well as my body. And so I have turned myself around in the wrong direction, maybe had my map pointing south instead of north, and have walked to the edge of a cliff thinking I was walking to a road. Luckily, I didn't step off the cliff.
Yeah, I haven't done orienteering myself. I've done a lot of disorienteering, though. We'll leave it there. Tom, thanks for joining us today.
Well, you're very welcome. Glad to be with you.
And Susie, thanks for being with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Rob.
That was Susie Madden, co-president and mapping director of the Badger Orienteering Club, and the club secretary, Tom Southworth. They talked with us about the sport after their first event of the spring season.
Green Bay will be at the center of the football world in 1 week with the kickoff of the NFL draft.
And that's going to bring a lot of visitors and attention to the region, and we want to hear from you. If you live in the area, are you looking forward to the event? Do you think it's going to bring more business to your workplace?
Do you watch the NFL draft each year? Are you excited it's in Green Bay, and are you going to see the event in person?
You are on the clock. We want to hear from you now. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Rochelle Wilson, and Colleen Leahy. Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.